Welcome. You're listening to the Gideon Warrior Radio Network. Look for us on TalkShoe.com. Type in keyword Gideon Warrior Network, and you can find us and other Israelite speakers at ChristianAmericanMinistries.com and AngloIsraelTruth.com. Please remember, your free will gifts and offerings help us to continue laboring in the vineyard. Please consider visiting our support page. We thank you for visiting our network and sites, and it's our prayer you'll be edified by them. Here's the message, and thanks for listening. This is part four in the series, America's Constitutional Idolatry. In this part four, we're going to subtitle this message, History and Fashioning the Idol. In part three, we began to study the idea of the constitutional requisite of virtuous leaders. We began to study some of the historical philosophical thinkers, which were instrumental in framing the ideas in the minds of those who were framing the Constitution for the United States of America. We ended it determining the common problem remained the same. How is man to create or foster these men of virtue? So in this part four, let's take a look at that virtuous leader. To be certain, we're not disillusioned by doctrine or preconceived notions or beliefs, let's take a moment to understand and in one sense develop in our minds how the divine immutable laws were structured. Speaking of only the Ten Commandments, we find four pertaining to our acknowledgement and consideration and love toward the Creator Himself. Then one command with the secondary procreative agency of father and mother being respected and honored. The next five relative to our successful interaction, honor, and respect with others. Consider how it could be recategorized in this way. Contrast this. Instead of God or Creator, we have of the people. Instead of parental or familial, by the people. Instead of community and neighboral, for the people. So we have of the people, by the people, for the people. We're told the framers extensively reviewed and borrowed from the Roman system of government, which included similar familial or tribal divisions. Beginning 500 years before Christ, Rome, successfully of sorts, wove religion and law into a governmental system from three organizational tribes of Roman people. Uniting came the first Senate comprised of 300 members, 100 from each of those tribes, with an immense amount of powers. This transitioned to a curial assembly, and then to a council of the hundreds, or comita centuriata, who elected two consuls or executives. They, with broad powers, often in conflict with each other and hostilities, which could dominate the Senate agenda. After 150 years, tribunes of the people were added, or tribuni plebis. Then, about 200 years later, a third legislative body, the Assembly of the Tribes, was added. Roman law was a powerful system in which, for the most part, the people believed they were a functional part. It kept the people at ease to worship their many gods. Is any of this sounding familiar? Their priests conducted worship services in accordance with the gods of Jupiter, Mars, Vesta, Bacchus, or others being served and worshipped. One could bring an offering to the temples of Jupiter, then go to the temple of Bacchus, the god of revelry and wine, where his offering would allow him to indulge in a sacramental drunkenness. And should he have money to spare, he could enter the temple of Vesta, the love goddess, and partake of the favors of her Vestal virgins. Oh yes, the pontiffs orchestrated and regulated the religious rites while interpreting the sacred laws, as well as a role in the development of civil and criminal law of Rome. Does this sound familiar? In the end, Romans could not satisfy the people in total, and emperors were frequently assassinated, but the philosophical thinkers were still searching for the universal system of law, which could be applied to the whole world, and Cicero was Rome's leader of this quest for peace, justice, and order. Cicero's basic tenet in formulating his ideas began with equating rulers of right living with the laws of creation's God, or the supreme creator of the universe. This requires an acknowledgement of a God or designer which ordered nature. These laws of creation were thus termed natural law. But Cicero must have wrestled with how he was going to balance Rome and Greek's many gods with this supreme God. Well, here's how. Quote, "Those who have reason in common must also have right reason in common, and since right reason is law, we must believe that men have law also in common with the gods. Hence, we must now conceive of this whole universe as one commonwealth of which both gods and men are members." End quote. Cicero proposed there would be, quote, "but one eternal and unchangeable law to be valid for all nations at all times, and there will be one master and ruler, that is God, over us all, for he is the author of this law, its promulgator, and its enforcing judge." Well, this is very much what the one world government and the one worlders, as they are termed, are all about. This was the source of the phrase the framers used often, the law of nature or nature's God. Not emanating from a profound belief in or respect and adherence to the divine immutable laws of God of Jacob Israel, as recorded in the Bible, but rather their interpretations of natural law, the laws of creation. Cicero went on to say, quote, "For these virtues originate in our natural inclination to love our fellow man, and this is the foundation of justice," end quote. Thus, Cicero had concluded the first natural law is to love the God of nature, and the second was like unto it, to love one's neighbor, and this is the foundation of justice. Continuing with Cicero, quote, "But the most foolish notion of all is the belief that everything is just which is found in the custom or laws of nations. What of the many deadly, the many pestilential statutes which nations put in force? These no more deserve to be called laws. Neither in a nation can a statute of any sort be called a law, even though the nation, in spite of being a ruinous regulation, has accepted it. But if the principle of justice were founded on the decrees of peoples, the edicts of princes, or the decision of judges, and so great a power belongs to the decrees of fools that the laws of nature can be changed by their votes, then why do they not ordain that which is bad and baneful shall be considered good and salutary?" End quote. Well, I would ask Cicero, if a law can make justice injustice, can it be expected to convert injustice to justice? This thinking is clearly already embodied in God's divine immutable laws and recorded in both the Old and New Testament to obey God rather than man, and that the judgment is from the Lord our God, the Creator. By now you can see that 500 years Rome had ruled under the various devices of representative government, so to speak. All in all, it was crumbling, and new thinkers were trying to save it. That's a very important thing for us to understand historically. Because so it is in America, less than half of Rome's history, and the American Republic is in desperate need of saving. But it is the governmental ordinances of men and the instrument itself which is propitiating its decline and eventual demise. But Rome was not yet finished. For 200 years it persecuted in various forms the seed of what became known as the followers of Christ or Christians. The seed of the woman, Christ gave the Apostle John a revelation into the future activities arrayed against the seed of the ways of Christ, the keepers of the commandments of God, and they which confess the testimony of Christ, Revelation 12:17. For 1260 years this seed was nourished in the wilderness, in the far reaches of Rome and elsewhere, Revelation 12:6, while Rome itself adopted Christianity under Emperor Constantine with the Emperor's Edict. This church-state relationship in Rome was not employed because the emperor and those to succeed him were going to be good Christians. No, just a means to saving the broken and withering empire. In other words, expediency. The most engaging summary of this 1260-year rule of Romish principle of law and rule is found in an address of Reuben Clark, November 21, 1952, from his book, Stand Fast by Our Constitution. Listen how he carefully constructs the history. Quote, following the pattern of the somewhat earlier private codification of Gregarious and Hierogenes at the time of Constantine, the Emperor Theodosius II and Valentinian III on March 26, 429 AD, appointed by imperial edict, the people were not consulted either directly or through representatives, a committee of jurists to prepare an official code. They prescribed what it was to contain. This code was prepared and presented to the Roman Senate some 9 years and 9 months later, December 25, 438 AD. That Senate, which had long since lost its power and was almost menially subservient to the emperor, received the code with shouts of approval. It is right. So be it. Accompanied by loud exclamations of oriental flattery for the emperor. There was no debate on the code by the Senate. No objection, no question, or dissent. The Senate did not so much as dot an I or cross a T. The code was wholly the offspring of the emperors. The people had no part whatever in it. We should understand that everything connected with the emperor was divine or sacred. There was the sacred imperial palace, the sacred imperial bedchamber, the sacred imperial wardrobe, the sacred laws, etc. The government was an absolute autocracy. The state was thoroughly militarized, the emperor in supreme command. The emperor was the sole source of law. By the simple issuance of a new law, the emperor could modify or repeal any previous law. All imperial utterances were considered divine or sacred. The contravention of a given law, as was often proclaimed, was sacrilege, and the punishment for sacrilege was death. The laws issued and codified were designed to keep secure this absolute, unchallenged power and authority of the emperor. It is interesting to note that these laws, proclaimed over 1,500 years ago, had provisions covering so-called modern concepts, which are immigrants, that is, from the Soviet Union, and fellow travelers who would have us believe are new inventions, such as price-fixing, black markets, excessive taxation, socialized medicine, conscriptions of labor, anti-Semitism, inflation, corruption in government bureaus, the relationship between church and state, all phrases familiar to our ears. Under these laws, the entire population was organized as in one vast army. All, including the highest officials, were strictly classified, and even the least had a station in substance. This meant that everyone did what he was told and did not act without permission. There was a great body of secret police to report disobedience. There was a special secret police appointed to watch the ordinary secret police. These laws were framed to provide security. We of today have heard that same kind of security talk, but in fact all this bred not security but scarcity of grain, materials, and men. The mere making of laws, even in absolute despotism, does not change the great laws of nature and economics, neither then nor now, for there can be no permanent stability where men are not free. In fewer than 40 years from the issuance of the Theodosian Code, That would have been in 476 AD. The Emperor of the West fell. Notwithstanding the operation under complete autocratic power of economic devices enacted to promote the welfare of the people and preserve the empire, some of these devices were the same ones that we have been told would rebuild our economic structure and preserve our free institutions. These devices failed with Rome. They will ultimately fail with us. He wasn't done. He goes now into the Code of Justinian. 90 years later, in 528 AD, Justinian, emperor of the Roman Empire of the East, struggling to preserve and build his empire by complete autocratic authority, called a noted jurist named Trebonian to collect about him a group of other jurists, there were nine others, and with them to complete the laws issued since the time of Constantine, to compile the laws issued since the time of Constantine, nearly 200 years before, 306 to 337 AD. The accumulation of the laws were said to be so voluminous as to fill 2,000 books and some 3 million verses, estimated to equal 580 volumes of 400 pages to a volume. Trebonian's compilations were in four parts: a code containing all the imperial statutes thought worthy of preserving from Hadrian, 117 to 138 AD, to Justinian; the Institutes, which contained the great elements of the civil law, but none of them embodying the principles of free government; the Pandects, declared to be the greatest repository of sound legal principles applied to the private rights and businesses of mankind that has ever appeared in any age or nation. Justinian called it the Temple of Human Justice; the Novels, a collection of new laws passed subsequent to the compilation of the Code to correct errors and supply omissions in the Code. The new Code was published in 534 AD. All of the sources on which the Justinian compilations were based, except the Theodosian Code, disappeared after the publication of Justinian's Code, Institutes, and Pandects. The works were composed and written in Latin and later translated in Greek. Undersecretary Reuben Clark continues, "While the absolute power of the emperor was implicit in the Theodosian Code, it was boldly announced in the Justinian compilations. The emperor had all legislative, judicial, and executive power in himself. Some affirm this principle had its origin during the reign of Augustus Caesar. Some trace it back to Romulus and the founding of Rome in 753 BC. This principle seems to have been basic to Roman law in the West for over 1,200 years, with almost 1,000 years more in the East, or until 1453 AD, when the Turks captured Constantinople. Thus it was inevitable that this principle of the autocratic power of the emperor, the executive, which was basic in the laws of Western and Southern Europe and portions of the Near East for over 2,000 years, should be a vital portion of the warp and woof of the laws of the continent of Europe. One other code may be mentioned here, a modern one, the Code of Napoleon. Having been appointed consul, Napoleon assigned a committee to make a codification of new laws. Napoleon assisted in the deliberations. Here again, the people were not consulted. It was compiled in 4 months and is said to be the product of the Roman and customary laws, the ordinance of the kings, and the laws of the revolution. This code is firmly entrenched in most of the countries of Europe and prevails amongst most of the Latin races. The Code of Napoleon, like the Theodosian and Justinian codes, did not originate with the legislative branch of government, nor on the initiative of the people. All those codifications originated with the ruler of the nation. Their provisions were dictated by him. The rigors of this system were at times mitigated by a benign sovereign, but only to the extent that he desired. Legislative bodies might at times be set up and function as he permitted, but any attempt by those bodies to go contrary to his will was somehow made ineffective, Sometimes such efforts were treasonable and so treated. The people under this system have those rights, powers, and privileges, and those only, which the sovereign considers are for their good and for his advantage. He adds or takes away as suits his royal pleasure. All residuum of powers remained in the emperor. Under this system, the people look into the law to see what they may do. They may only do what the emperor has declared they may do. It may be noted in passing that under our, meaning the English common law system, we look into the law to see what we may not do, for we may do everything we are not forbidden to do. We must always remember that despotism and tyranny, with all their attendant tragedies to the people, as in Russia, come to nations because one man or a small group of men seize and exercise by themselves the three great divisions of government, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial. For now, a score of centuries, the nations and peoples of Western and Southern Europe, the bulk of the civilized world, have lived under this Roman civil law concept, and, when the concept has been operative, have suffered the resulting tragedies, loss of liberty, oppression, great poverty among the masses, insecurity, wanton disregard of human life, and a host of the relatives of these evil broods. End quote. Now that is quite a construct of the history. Reuben Clark was undersecretary in the United States in 1952. Now, while all this organized church-state religion was being employed throughout the Empire of Rome, something had been happening to those which flew off to the wilderness to be nourished and protected. The law of God written on the hearts of his people, as Hebrews 8:7-11 conveys, began to emerge from areas north, south, east, and west. In fact, from the apocryphal writings from Destiny Publishers in 2 Esdras 13:40-47, we read, quote, "They would leave the multitude of the heathen and go forth into further country, where never mankind dwelt, that they might keep their statutes which they never kept in their own land," end quote. Who are these people? Glad you asked. They were the Scythians, or the 10 northern tribes, and their descendants, known as the Goths, Visigoths, Danites, Jutes, Scots, Danes, Germans, Swedes, Dutch, Belgium, Lombards, Franks, Normans, Scandinavian, the Anglo-Saxon and kindred peoples, who left the regions of the Black Sea precisely where the 10-tribed Israel became, quote, lost. Now, one thing that happened to the people of England was King Alfred, but in 1066, the Normans of France, William the Conqueror, invaded and conquered England, bringing with it, yup, Roman law. After seven rulers and 150 years, by 1215, the conquered Anglo-Saxons of England had had enough and forced the king at the edge of a sword to sign the Magna Carta. This did little to alleviate their problems, and the divine right of kings doctrine continued for 300 years. When James I ascends the throne and the 1611 King James Bible was published, the past 200 years had ushered in Bibles all over Europe, due to the invention of the printing press and the works of John Huss, John Wycliffe, in translating it to the native English tongue. Like the Church of Rome, the Church of England degraded into debauchery, complete with indulgence, child baptism, and the purchasing of the rights to parish offerings, to satisfy their own appetites and lusts of the heart. The dissenters and objectors of the decadent church became known as separatists and Puritans. It would be 1627, just 2 years after his father James I's death, that the Petition of Right was presented to King Charles, who reluctantly gave his consent. Facing war from France, but not undaunted in the least, and rejecting the demand he ordered, Parliament was dissolved for the third time. It is this, Charles I, which had a lot to do with English thinking of that era, which had a strong influence on the protections or the preservation of right, and it would appeal to the framers. But as time has proven, it was woefully ineffective. Charles had failed to call a single parliament for more than a decade, and here's a short list of his actions: making arbitrary, or one might say, political arrests, in other words, calculated for maximum impact; quartering soldiers and citizens home; suspending habeas corpus while extending a totalitarian tyranny on citizenry in the political sphere. He created a court of high commission when he wished to rule over the religious affairs, and imposing debt burdens by forced indebtedness for his causes, and levying taxes for any conceivable need, just to name a few. The continued degradation of the Church of England, complete with its heresies and false doctrines, succeeded in forcing two civil wars. Oliver Cromwell became the military force putting to rest the civil unrest in a fragment and disbanded parliament resulting from Pride's Purge of 1648. A 56-member parliament would arrest and charge King Charles for treason, and a 150-member commission found him guilty. The 30th of January 1649, he was beheaded on a gallows erected in front of his banqueting hall. It's nearly 125 years before the North America continent would engage in its own war for independence. The year 1653, a group of men in the appointed parliament undertook a task of creating England a new constitution called, quote, the Instruments of Government, end quote, containing 42 articles. However, its imperfections were immediately apparent, and by 1654, Cromwell was accused for all of England's woes, complete with the usual taxation without representation, arrests without due process, government by force, and trials without juries. Within a decade of Charles I beheading, his son Charles II had ascended the throne. Due to Cromwell's death, Cromwell's son Richard's abdication of power, and the people's clamoring for a return to royalty, return he did, and for 25 years he ruled England. A couple years before his death, he beheaded Algernon Sidney for having dared to proclaim that God had vested all sovereignty in the people and disavowing the notion of divine right of kings. This thinking would become the predominant thinking out of English nations for the next 100 years, leading to the American War for Independence, 1776. I think we'll stop here, and we will pick up on this next part of this message series, where we can get into these various concepts then that were alive and well in that 100-year period leading up to the War for Independence in 1776. I think it'll be a good breaking point here for us, and we'll pick it up then in part 5. Stay tuned. Once again, I remain thankful for the opportunity to minister unto those of the New Covenant, as Hebrews 8:8 informed us of. This is Doug Nelson, trusting you will hear these words one day. Well done, thou good and faithful servant.